Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, where it's 10 past 2 a.m. and we are on the whiskey. Whiskey bought for us, or more specifically bought for David, by Pam Shriver. Hello, Pam.
Hi, so
Pam. This podcast is brought to you not only in partnership with AO Travel, but also with Pam Shriver's Scotch.
It's nice.
So we'll see how this goes. Our women's final lineup is set. 19-year-old Coco Gauff against future world number one. Come Monday, she will be the world's number one player, Aryna Sabalenka. What a Saturday night in New York that is going to be. What a Thursday night in New York it has been, David.
Yeah, it really has been a lot, actually, today, hasn't it? And I didn't necessarily think it would go like that, particularly because of the way the first sets of both matches went. I was really worried about how it was all going to go. Obviously, there was a non-tennis moment that we'll come on to as well, 45 moments, actually, that interrupted playing the Gauff-Mukova match. But actually, in many ways, the second match is the one that I'm just glad became a real tussle, because it was going horribly wrong from a Sabalenka point of view. And I don't feel as though Keys can leave that court with too many regrets. Obviously, she would have loved to get over the line, but she played hard and she played well, and she just lost to somebody who's better in those moments, I thought.
Well, let's lead with that match, shall we? Love 6-7, 6-7, 6-6 for Aryna Sabalenka. I know in lots of ways Coco Gauff reaching the final is the bigger story, and we'll cover that in lots of detail, but we've just watched Sabalenka come back from the most horrible of starts against Madison Keys, and we're kind of still reeling from it. An hour ago, we were still on Arthur Ashe Stadium watching Aryna Sabalenka celebrate what she thought was match point when she got to 7.
Oh, I forgot about that.
In the match tiebreak. We're kind of still in that moment. We're still buzzing from all of it. So let's kind of capitalise on that and look back on one of the most wild semi-finals I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and one of the most impressive mental performances that I've ever seen from a player, to be quite honest, because Aryna Sabalenka has so much Grand Slam semi-final baggage. I know that she's won one before and won the Australian Open, but it still feels like this is a hurdle that she hadn't properly sort of overcome, you know, in a really tight match before. She beat Magda Linette in straight sets in January. And she came out against a player in Madison Keys who was timing the ball so sweetly, playing about as well as she can and about as well as anyone can, really. It was awesome from Madison Keys. Same time, Sabalenka was off. And she drops that first set 6-love. And honestly, I had absolutely no idea what was going to happen in this match from this point onwards. I felt like Madison Keys could fall off. I felt like Sabalenka could carry on playing as she was. I felt like a turnaround was possible. And that was what happened. And there was almost this sense of, well, if you never have the lead, you can't blow a lead. Because that's been Sabalenka's problem in semifinals. She's been in winning positions and not been able to get over the line. So in that sense, in this weird way, losing that first set 6-love was maybe a little bit helpful, because she never had the lead in this match. Even when she, you know, started to get it together in the second set, Keys was still in a position to serve for the match. Sabalenka then played a great 12 points in a row to win them. I'm sure we'll come on to Madison Keys. I think she'll have some regrets about that period of the match. But once Sabalenka won that tiebreak in the second set, I thought, OK, now this is another test for Sabalenka, because she's now in a position where maybe she can win this match. And she falls behind again in the third set, down a break. But then, kind of like, OK, that's maybe better than being in a winning position in that third set because of what's happened before. And from that point onwards, from a breakdown in the third set, I thought Sabalenka was absolutely awesome. She stepped up. She played big, powerful tennis. She played world number one tennis. And it was great to see. And it feels like a really big moment in her career, to be honest, that she's overcome some of that baggage.
Yeah, I had the same feelings about the mental fortitude of that performance, and a very specific type of mental fortitude. We're not talking about Nadal-esque mental fortitude, where it's like, as soon as a point is finished, it's gone. It's disappeared from his mind and he's refocused on the next one. I mean, some of her body language after that first set was extraordinarily bad. She got a warning from sportsmanlike conduct, didn't she? She tossed her racket not quite into the stands, but in the direction of her team. There was all sorts of remonstrations towards them. She was complaining about how well Madison Keys was playing. The Grand Slam semi-final, how dare she play this well, was pretty much the gist of it. It was, you know, it was not world number one type stuff. And it certainly wasn't the type of stuff that made you think, don't worry, she's going to put that first set behind her and she's going to play like it never happened. And she didn't play like it never happened. You know, it's not like suddenly she turned it on and it was forgotten. It never felt easy for Aryna Sabalenka tonight. It always felt on the edge. And yet, even so, she kept going for it. And I think that's an incredible testament to her.
She might have the odd kind of tantrum, really. I mean, it was funny. Like, she stamps her feet like a toddler. It's so funny. And then she chucked her racket up in the air, as you say, nearly landed. And it ends up down the sort of side, like, alleyway.
Down a sort of back alley.
Yes. Yeah. Which is funny. I was just thinking when you were saying the scoreline of Love 6 might have actually helped her. I was thinking, has that sentence ever been used before? Like, I mean, it's just, and I agree with you, because I remember saying it at the time. It's not a strategy you have, is it? But it may end up being the thing that happens.
Well, I also worried about it. Take away Sabalenka and all of her semi-final baggage. I worried about that scoreline from a Madison Keys point of view, because lots of ex-tennis players, top-level ex-tennis players, will say that actually it's a bit of a disaster losing a set. 6-love.
Winning a set 6-love.
Sorry, winning a set. I mean, also losing a set 6-love in a different way. Winning a set 6-love is actually one of the worst score lines to win from, because, you know, depending on how mentally strong you are, and I find this extremely relatable, you're thinking, oh my God, it can only go downhill from here, right? Yeah. I can't keep it up. The chances of this being a 6-love are minuscule. Therefore, something's got to give way here. And I totally understand that mindset. And look, let's come on to talk about where the Madison Keys will and should have regrets, but it definitely wasn't as simple as Madison Keys winning a first set 6-love and freezing because the only way is down from there. That is not the story of this match.
I haven't spoken to her yet, and I'm sure she'll be sad and she'll be disappointed, and maybe she will have regrets, but I don't feel that she should be beating herself up about it. I thought she played way better than she's played in years. I mean, obviously she's got to a semi-final and she really went for it, and she went toe-to-toe with the world number one, who's hitting the ball that hard, and she was out-hitting her. Her strike is so pure, it's a joke when she really is on. When I was watching it, I was thinking, if this is Coco Gauff, she's rolling these balls high up to Keys to try to stop this. And I'm thinking, I never thought I would ever think that Sabalenka should stop trying to out-hit somebody and actually try to slow ball them. But that's what Keys was doing to her. She was winning the toe-to-toe showdown, which is an incredible sight, because there were some actually extended rallies. It wasn't just all unforced errors. But so to me, I ended up really enjoying the match, because I feel like you kind of got them both. You got them both playing. She went off to this great lead, and then Sabalenka just reeled her in and then found a form when it really mattered. So it sort of felt about right.
It was the match I wanted to see from Madison Keys. I wanted to see her involved in a close contest with a top player and her to live with her and stay with her. And she did do that. I think she played a bad game when she served for the match. Sabalenka nailed some returns, which helped. But Keys let that go, I think, that game. That was a loose game, and she hadn't... It felt quite over to me, the match. It was drifting in that second set towards Keys serving it out. And when she didn't, the whole thing changed. And then it was a really good tussle. I thought Sabalenka was the better player in the third set overall, but Keys was staying with her despite having gone off court and had a lot of strapping put on her leg in between the second and third sets. I thought Madison Keys was great tonight. And actually, you know, you sort of apologised to her last night. I feel like I owe Madison Keys a bit of an apology tonight, because I didn't think she'd do that tonight. I thought this would be more one-sided for Aryna Sabalenka. And I thought Keys was exceptional and has been all tournament. And it was a absolutely thrilling contest. And for Sabalenka, the point you made about how she got that warning and how she let some of her emotions out, I thought very interesting quote she gave on the court afterwards, sort of referring back to some of the previous semi-finals, where she sort of spoke to her team and said she needed to let those emotions out, because otherwise, quote, I would eat myself from the inside.
And incredible line, wasn't it, in the moment, incredible. In a second language.
And said in a sort of quite, I don't know, she was in a sort of slightly giddy mood, wasn't she, in that on-court interview. But that was an absolutely killer line. And I can't honestly remember exactly how she was sort of outwardly emoting in all those Grand Slam semifinals that she's lost. But interesting that she feels like just getting it out of her system rather than bottling it up was maybe one of the keys today. And, you know, she never that was not intentional. She never overstepped the line there, but just shows that I think she's been thinking about those other semifinals and trying to learn from them, and she did that tonight.
The match reminded me of Sabalenka-Rybakina.
Not as high quality.
They're absolutely not. But in terms of, I had sort of written it off as they're such similar players. It'll just be about, you know,
unforced error fest.
Yeah, we know those matchups. You've got two big hitters up against one another. One is more consistent than the other. Boom, done. And it wasn't like that at all. And I'd totally forgotten. I can't actually remember the last time I watched Madison Keys live in the stadium. But I had forgotten what a pure hitter she is. It's such a different big hit to Aryna Sabalenka. And that was my impression of the Australian Open final that Sabalenka played with Rybakina in their Indian Wells final. As well, that their strikes, when you see them up close, the strikes are actually really, really different. It's there's so much more not to take anything away from the incredible muscle of the Sabalenka strike, but the purity of the Madison Keys strike is really beautiful. And I'm so pleased that she gave a good account of herself today. How much of a comfort it'll be, I don't know. I think she shrugs off disappointment far better and far differently than she used to. When she reached that Australian Open semi-final last year, she talked about, well, she put into words something that so many tennis players express at some point in their careers, about that process of trying to find a way for your whole happiness and your whole self-esteem not to depend on your tennis results. And she talked then about having found that in her life. So I'm sure she'll be fine in the end, but I'm sure it hurts a lot right now.
I do feel like she's, I don't know whether she's had therapy or what sort of help she's had, but I think she's had to learn, as you say, to come to terms with the results not necessarily matching the hype, including her own, you know, her expectations. And it's not easy for a teenager to come along like that with that much talent and that much expectation and constantly be reminded that you haven't delivered on it in quite the way people thought you were. And they're sort of imposing their... And I'm one of the ones guilty. I would have imposed my expectations on her as a member of the media. She wouldn't know that necessarily, but the whole she would know about. You know, the kind of relentless pressure and expectation, they feel that. Even if they're not reading it, they feel it. Him and her and Grigor Dimitrov, they are similar in that way. And I think that she's probably learnt to live a happy life because of it. I noticed she said that it's quite nice that nobody's taking any notice of her. It's all about Coco Gauff, and it's also about a little bit about Jessica Pegula, and she's not the one anymore, so she can kind of distance herself from it, and she's clearly happier as a result, and she's probably playing better now as a result. Be interesting to see whether there's anything more down the pipe for her.
And that's it, isn't it? That I'm so pleased. That all sounds so healthy for Madison Keys.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you got the sense that Sabalenka's will was bigger tonight.
Absolutely.
She
couldn't have handled it, really.
Right.
She'd have been a mess for several days.
Exactly.
If she hadn't.
And she went out and got it. And that sounds like such a sort of flippant thing to say from a tennis match that I'm sure was, you know, won and lost, I'm sure with a lot of tactical battles as well. But will and desire and sort of champion's mentality comes into it as well. And Sabalenka's shown and proved that she's got that. And Madison Keys, as great as she was just missing that little edge.
Yeah, I think this is such a brutal sport. I do think you have to be basically mentally unhinged to be the most successful at it, to be at the very, very top. And that leads to a tension for podcasters, for example, doesn't it? Because we want the best for tennis players, and we want their best performances, and we want to see fangs out there, and yet, you know, see this discussion and many others. Quite often that you sort of deep down know that means rooting for something quite dark.
Yeah.
Actually, it's far healthier to be how Madison Keys is. And yet I'm thinking, oh, but what a shame you didn't have just a tiny bit more fang.
There are odds, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a discord when you think about them, because I do care about their mental health and their happiness as human beings. But yes, it's also great to see the champions. Somebody like Sabalenka, I kind of feel like her happiness is wrapped up in whether she wins or not to quite a large degree. I think that peace is often only comes when she's over the line.
Mm. Can we talk, just before we move on to the first of the semi-finals, could we just devote a tiny bit more attention to Sabalenka celebrating it when she reached seven in the tie break?
Describe it.
Well, my experience of it was leaning over to Matt and going, look at all these chumps with their phone out, filming, thinking this is match point. And it turned out that the world number one was also one of those chumps.
And I'd very excitedly celebrated the fact that a game earlier, I'd realised that it was going to be a 10-point tiebreak, because I always forget as well. And I've often gone into them as a commentator, and fortunately, somebody has just referenced it, not telling me, and I've just been like, oh, I'd completely forgotten that. So, yes, I'd remembered, so I was very proud of myself. And then they announced it at the start of the tiebreak. Yeah. They very clearly announced it. Everybody in the stadium must know. Aryna Sabalenka absolutely must know. And then they get to, what was it, 6-3, something like that.
Yeah.
And she wins the point and she throws the racket on the ground in celebration.
Yeah, it wasn't something you could style out.
No. And it went on for a few seconds.
Because she turned her back on the court and went to celebrate with her team. So she wasn't seeing any of the indicators that might make her realise. And this all goes to what we've already discussed, which is her mental strength. But just to come back from that without blinking.
And also because I feel like she's slightly self-deprecating in those moments. She's humorous. And she saw the funny side. She was able to say the funny side when the team is saying, no, you haven't finished yet. And she didn't blink. She was amazing. She won it twice.
It was such a great moment. I just know it's one of those moments that I'll remember in years to come. It'll really stand out. What'll probably stand out to me from Coco Gauff's 6-4, 7-5 victory over Karolina Muchová is the last half hour, and in particular the last game of this match. I think that'll live long in my memory, which is probably giving the match too much credit, because large portions of it were truly horrific. But, you know, the first... Has there ever been a greater contrast between the first half hour of a match and the last half hour of a match? I honestly don't think I have ever seen one.
It was so deflating, the first seven games. I mean, Coco Gauff played nicely. Karolina Muchová was absolutely appalling. I mean, I don't know whether it was nerves or what, but, you know, this player of such beautiful timing couldn't time the ball. She couldn't get it in. It was like when Cameron Norrie has a bad day. You know, it was just terrible.
Cameron Norrie catching strays.
Always from David.
Always.
But, I mean, you're right, when she... I mean, obviously, there was the big palaver in the middle, but, I mean, when she found a timing at the end and started to really sink her teeth into the match and fight, and that's when it was at its absolute peak, because you've got them both just pulling at the rope and trying to yank it off each other.
It was truly one of the weirdest tennis matches that I've seen. I mean, three acts. Act one, just a total horror show. I mean, there were seven winners between them and 29 unforced errors in the first set. And I think that's a generous 29.
I'd agree, yeah.
Was it 6-1 set?
No, it was
6-4. Because Coco Gauff didn't play very well either.
It was 5-1.
She had her own little period in there.
Completely lost her forehand.
You wouldn't know that I'd commentated on it, would you?
I mean, Coco Gauff's forehand broke down in that first set after she was 5-1 up. And suddenly all Muchová had to do was find the court, which she was having big trouble doing. But when she started doing it, Gauff responded with a series of unforced errors. And it was so awkward and so bad and so terrible. Mary Carrillo said she'd never seen a major semi-final that bad first set quality-wise. It was so bad.
And Gauff was just rolling it, wasn't she? To entice the errors.
Yeah. Right, which wasn't a bad tactic. Like, no. She was looping that forehand, really targeting the Muchová backhand, and the Muchová forehand was all over the place to begin with as well. It was I think, cannot stress enough how bad it was.
I think the horror of Mukova's performance infected Coco Gauff because she had no rhythm. Her mind must have been swirling with, well, the same things our mind was swirling with like, is this tennis? Like, this, it just must have been such a different match to the one that she prepared for. Karolina Mukova, the more experienced player in that scenario and on that stage, and look, we previewed this match last night and we were all absolutely on a knife edge about this one and which way it would go. There were lots of different scenarios, but one that I hadn't even countenanced was Karolina Mukova freezing like that for a set.
Mm.
I think I mentioned Ons Jabeur Wimbledon final in my commentary.
Wow, yeah.
And I couldn't see, because we're a long way away, I couldn't see the face of Mukova to be able to judge what's going on out there.
Well, she doesn't give much away in that respect.
So, yeah, but it was that haunting in terms of how bad it was.
And then at One Love in the second set, at which point, by the way, I marked this down, it was 32-1 full service to 8 winners. And I would say the 32 was ungenerous and the 8 was generous.
Not a great ratio.
It's not a great ratio. At that point, there was a kerfuffle. A kerfuffle whose nature did not really become clear for quite a long time. And actually, a lot of the clarity was provided by Molly McElwee of The Telegraph, who went and did some up-close reporting on this. There were 3 protesters in the stand. They were wearing T-shirts that bore the words End Fossil Fuels, so very similar to the Just Stop Oil protesters that have been very prominent in the UK recently and over the summer over major sporting events. 2 of those protesters were removed without too much fuss. There was a stoppage to play, but, you know, sort of unremarkable amount of fuss. But one of them glued his bare feet to the floor, which meant that security, the NYPD and medics had to be involved in the extraction process. And as I say, the exact details of all of that did only sort of became clear, filtered through over the course of a 45-minute period, 45-minute stoppage in the match. We were seeing shots of both players and their teams backstage while you're seeing sort of stuff come through on social media about what's going on with these protesters. The USTA eventually released a statement explaining why it took so much time. They said the fan in question affixed himself to the floor, and due to the nature of the action, medical professionals, NYPD and security personnel were needed in order to resolve the issue. And this is another one where there's a huge amount of tension here, because it was horrible to see that. It was absolutely not what any of us want to see in a Grand Slam semi-final or at any time during a major sporting event. I felt for the spectators. I felt for the players hugely. I mean, just terrible for the players and their teams and everybody. I felt for us. It's cost us an hour of sleep. I'll miss that tomorrow. Dreadful. Don't want to see it. But equally, there is a climate crisis. The world is ending. We've had evidence of that the last 4 days here in New York. And, you know, that if you're looking hard enough and you don't have to look that hard, there is evidence of it everywhere you look. And these people were peacefully trying to do something about that. And I'm not going to go out there and do it, but I'm also not going to come down on them like a ton of bricks for peaceful protest about something that is worthy of peaceful protest, because protest by definition has to be disruptive in order to be effective. That is the point. If it weren't disruptive, it would be pointless.
I couldn't agree more, and it was great to hear yet again Coco Gauff say that she believes in climate change and the problems that it's causing, and she understands that people need to protest or want to protest, and she doesn't have any problem with that. She says, yes, I wish it wasn't during my match, as it happens tonight, because obviously I'm trying to win a tennis match and it's not ideal. But I think you summed it up perfectly, Catherine. I've got nothing else to add.
Mm. Oh, okay.
That's rare,
should we
it?
Go back to the unforced error to winner ratio then? Because that was a treat.
The only thing I would say, and I don't know how hard to be on the US Open for this, but the speed that it took for them to act seemed insufficient to me. Just as a layperson, watching Brad Gilbert turning around, pointing at people, the match being interrupted, and it seemed to take a long time. Now, for all I know, the protester who actually glued his feet to the floor may have already done that, and therefore there may have been nothing that anybody could have done to get him out. But the video footage we saw, they got the other two out, and this gentleman... They didn't, but it did seem to take a long time versus what I remember at Wimbledon, and the communication at Wimbledon being, this is likely to happen. We're expecting it to happen. We're beefing up security, but the chances are it'll still probably happen. And yeah. I didn't get that sense that there was a preparedness in quite
no,
that same way.
No, it was
way.
Interesting. Look, I was watching on the ESPN feed. And as soon as I heard it was protesters, my assumption was that it was just Stop Oil or something similar, because we are so attuned to that. I'm expecting there to be something from climate activists at major sporting events now, or certainly an attempt at something. And yet the tone of the coverage, and I could be wrong about this, indicated to me that it just wasn't on their radar at all as something that might happen. So maybe it's just been less prominent here in the US. I don't know, but yeah, you know, I know that at Wimbledon and other major sporting events over the summer, it was a massive topic of discussion, doing what can be done to prevent those protests. But ultimately, I'm not sure you can police people bringing t-shirts and glue.
No, and I mean,
into a sporting event like this,
24,000 people. I mean, it is an enormous. It's hard to describe the humanity out there. The number of people you're mixing with in a tennis stadium. This isn't a football ground with a 100-meter pitch and the stadium surround or an NFL stadium. It's just such an enormous number of people. But I did. I'm sure they will be looking at it and trying to improve that situation. Because, look, again, you've highlighted the competing emotions we have when looking at protesters and the feelings we have about it. But, you know, what if it wasn't protesters? What if it was something else? I don't know whether the reaction would have been much, much quicker. I mean, there is an incredible... security presence,
but all they were
floor.
Doing was sitting there and chanting, right, and gluing their
yes.
feet to the ground. So it's hard to judge whether they would not act quicker or more drastically.
Yeah.
If
I think they probably would,
exactly.
Yeah, they probably would, wouldn't they?
So anyway, back to that winner and unforced error ratio, which at that point was in a sorry state. Look, things didn't improve enough to rescue that ratio at the end of the match. And things, it wasn't like they came back out after that 45-minute delay and it was a brand new tennis match straight away. It wasn't as simple as that, but it was given the opportunity to evolve into something at first decent and then at the end, briefly, sensational.
Yeah, I mean, we've been waiting for a memorable, high-quality match in this tournament, to be quite honest. We've been waiting a long time. and we didn't get a full match of it, but we got half an hour of the most compelling, dramatic, high quality, thrilling tennis there. And Mary Carrillo said as soon as they came back out that she liked the sound of the match better. I thought that was a really good way of putting it, because they were both suddenly striking the ball a bit with, you know, with more intent, a bit more cleanly. And as you said, it wasn't brilliant straight away, but it evolved into something absolutely epic. And that period of the match, the last few games, was Mukova playing her very best stuff. And I thought that would be good enough to beat Coco Gauff. I thought that she would have too many ways to win points. And I was wrong, because Coco Gauff stood up to it in the most fantastic way. I mean, Mukova started coming forward and making volleys that she'd been missing. And Coco Gauff responded by trying to lengthen the rallies. There was this incredible 40-shot rally where I think I made my debut on Czech radio, because I was sat next to Czech radio guy, as I have been all tournament, and I had a physical reaction to the rally. I couldn't.
It was like he pressed an ejector button. He leapt that far off his seat with a yelp.
And then at the same time, we had David over our shoulder actually commentating on it and making it even more dramatic and intense. It was a sort of out of body experience.
it was a special time, wasn't it? It was just locked in a bit of magic.
Yeah,
that final game,
as match points were coming and going for Coco Gauff,
and forehand errors.
There was forehand errors on some of the match points. There was a couple of outstanding Mukova drive volleys to save a couple
so
of them.
So gutsy.
It was like, how could someone play the tennis she played at the start of the match and then play that tennis match point down?
That's like, what I love about sports and love incredible. About tennis is the ways people can sometimes just get over whatever's afflicting them and then just boom, they're on it. Oh, so good.
She's told ESPN after the match, Coco Gauff, that she's sure that this Grand Slam final will be different to the last one that she played at the French Open. She said, "First time around, I put too much pressure on the moment. I don't think I believed in myself then. I believe in myself now."
Great line. I think she knows herself more as a tennis player now. I think probably the new coaching setup has helped a little with that. But she's experienced. Her rolling these forehands down the line is such a clever way of hiding her weakness and hurting a powerful opponent. I can see that happening time and time again to Aryna Sabalenka.
Was that a prediction, David?
I haven't made a prediction yet, but I have made a prediction about what I think she will do. I haven't told you what I think will happen when she does it, score-wise.
Well, we will have more time on tomorrow night's podcast.
Yes, we will.
To preview the women's final, Coco Gauff in her second Grand Slam final.
It's a belter on paper.
Against Aryna Sabalenka in her second Grand Slam final.
Mm. Yeah. It's hard to believe that, isn't it? Because she's been consistent this year, yes, she's world number one, but it is still new.
Mm. It's the perfect final, isn't it?
It's so great.
It has, storyline-wise, it's mouth-watering.
And the crowd, without exception, everybody will turn up knowing exactly what they want. They will want Coco Gauff to win. Bless Keys, if she'd have won this title, all good luck to her. But in terms of the occasion, we saw it when she played Stevens. The crowd don't really know what to do. They might pick a favourite, but a lot of them are Americans, and there are two Americans. Mm. Here you have absolutely the player they're going to root for. Sabalenka makes a brilliant villain, because she's not really a villain. She's just lovable, really, in a way.
It's a pantomime villain.
Yes, pantomime villain, exactly. But it all works, I think, for the occasion. I hope they, as always, they both settle and play the way they can.
I'm quite confident in that final being good. I don't know why I would say that after tonight. Ask me again when it's love to someone in the first set.
I mean, I agree with you, but and the beauty of tonight is that both of those two matches turned into something good, even though they started like...
Say it.
Absolute dog shit, David.
Yeah.
Duffers. Dog shit.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Right, we have a few minutes to preview the men's semi-finals tomorrow, or later on the day, today, depending on how you look at it. Before we do that, I'm going to remind you about the incredible competition that we are running in association with our partners for this US Open, AO Travel. If you didn't already know, AO Travel operate the travel program for the first Grand Slam of the year, the Australian Open in Melbourne in January. AO Travel offer packages where they take care of everything, your flights, your premium accommodation, tickets to the tournament, behind the scenes experiences, and that includes the all new AO Travel Lounge, and it is to celebrate the launch of that very AO Travel Lounge that we are offering an incredible prize to one lucky Tennis Podcast listener and a friend who will win an AO Travel Premium Lounge package to the Australian Open in January. They'll be going in style, two return economy flights to Melbourne, tickets to Rod Laver Arena over the middle weekend of the Open for two people, three nights accommodation at the five-star Pullman on the Park Hotel in Melbourne, as well as two-day access to the luxurious AO Travel Lounge. You enter via the link provided in your show notes. You have until Monday the 18th of September at 11:59 p.m. New York time to enter. Terms and conditions apply, and most importantly, good luck.
Yeah, middle weekend tickets to go and see the Australian Open. What a brilliant few days that is.
American Andrew was at the Open, and in fact might be returning to the Open because he said he would try and come back if Coco Gauff reached the final.
He will be. He's got his ticket.
Oh, has fantastic.
He? Yeah. He bought it. Well, he bought his ticket in advance.
Oh.
And he was gonna sell it if Coco Gauff wasn't in the final.
He's got it all sorted.
That's good planning.
Mm. Sell it and potentially lose some money.
That's a man that's familiar with Ticketmaster.
He was on our Twitter today, just doing an amazing
belting job. What I was going to say is that Andrew always gets the Labor Day middle weekend package to the US Open, which obviously different Grand Slam, but he swears by the middle weekend package being the thing to have.
I know you're not into quarterfinals.
I was going to say, it's good that those tickets aren't quarterfinals after they trash the quarterfinals.
What do you make
it?
Of the middle weekend?
Great.
That's a good time.
Perfect. I like it too.
Yeah.
Coming for the final is also good, Andrew.
Yeah.
You've nailed it.
Yeah.
You've nailed the US Open.
It's all good. Don't you listen to that.
men's singles semi-finals tomorrow. What's going to happen?
I think they're both going to be fun. I think...
That's vague, David.
I think Ben Shelton is going to bring it, and he's going to hurt Djokovic.
For a set?
He's going to rock him.
Or in a meaningful way?
I think he's going to win a set.
No.
At least a set.
I think he's going to win it. I think he might rock him for the first set, and then Djokovic will take over. I think he'll rock him, but not in a meaningful way.
I think he'll rock him twice.
Djokovic in five, you think?
I think Djokovic in four, okay. I think. I will finalise that view when I do my newsletter prediction. Which needs to be
extremely soon, David.
At 3 a.m.
We're planning to go to bed pretty soon after we finish this. Matt?
I think they might both be straight sets.
Matt Roberts.
I mean, I get everything wrong, so that's great news for those two semi-finals.
Extremely possible.
Well, cool. Yeah, I mean, it's probably the most likely scenario, isn't it, really? Given the way those two
plan for the worst, hope for the best.
Yes.
We are Brits, after all.
Yeah, maybe I'm not sure. Maybe I don't feel like a Brit the way I'm so optimistic for amazing classics, but I do think they're going to be fun though. Well, the beauty is because these two matches feature players who are such shot makers, and then Medvedev, who may not be that much of a shot maker, but he's brilliant on the run and stuff like that, and he's got his personality. There's no duds there.
It does feel a bit to me like a Wimbledon situation where I wish they were the other way around.
Yeah, wouldn't that be good?
So you would like to see Medvedev, Djokovic,
yeah,
yes,
and Shelton and Alcaraz, yes, yes, whipping up a showtime.
A thousand times, yes.
If they could arrange that tomorrow.
I want to see Medvedev, even if it is disastrous, I want to see him try something different and fun against Alcaraz, because his game doesn't work. And he is a tactician, isn't he? That's his thing.
Should he?
He caught... There's that... Ahead of the quarterfinal with Rublev, that video was circulating, the intercut video of him and Rublev, who are obviously best mates, going back a long way, with Medvedev saying his nickname among all the other players is the chess master, and explaining why it's that. It's because I'm such a master tactician. Everyone says I'm just such a chess player out there. And Rublev goes, no, octopus.
It's very funny.
It's brilliant. But like, yeah, you're a chess master. Do something chessy tomorrow. And it could absolutely fail, but you've tried.
I think he will. I think that's what he will try. My question for you, Catherine, is should he try disruptor? What I mean is, should he find something to get pissed off about and just go the whole pantomime, people in the crowd, look, umpire?
I'd love to see it, but I don't think he ever goes on the court consciously looking to do
should
that.
Should he? And would you be okay with it if he did?
No, because it needs to be organic.
Okay.
That's why we love him, isn't it?
I'm afraid I agree with you.
Just quickly, before we have one final little treat for you in terms of men's semi-final preview, I will give you some more detail on what's going on in the wheelchair events tomorrow, because they're progressing as well as the junior events. But we have our men's doubles semi-finalists. It will be, once again, for the third time in a row, Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury. They will take on Rohan Bopanna and Matt Ebden. Very well done, Bopanna and Ebden, but you did beat Pierre Hugobert and Nicolas Mahut.
Yeah.
Mm. Rohan Bopanna, I believe, is the oldest man ever to reach a Grand Slam final.
Is that right?
He's overtaken Daniel Nestor's record.
He's got a grey beard.
Like, he does.
And has had for a while.
And he seems very proud of it.
And we were watching Stefan Oudé earlier in the men's wheelchair doubles semi-final, which he and partner Takashi Sanada won over Alfie Hewitt and Gordon Reid, 7-5, 7-6. How old is Stefan Oudé, Matt? We looked it up because, well, he looked quite old. So we wanted to check.
52.
That's great, isn't it?
Fantastic. He's into the final. Oh, incredible.
That is something else.
But yeah, I promised you an extra little men's semi-final preview treat, in particular for the first semi-final. David, over to you.
Yeah, this is a conversation I got to have. I got to meet Brian Shelton at Wimbledon, the father of Ben Shelton. And over the past year, I've really just generally been interested in this story because Ben came on our radar really properly. I know a lot of you who really follow the circuit will have known more about him last year. For us, and certainly for me, it was really at the Australian Open this year when he reached the quarterfinals. I got a chance to have a little chat with him at that time. He had never left the country until he went to Australia, and I found that absolutely fascinating. And I was given the chance to meet Brian, his dad, who was a former ATP player. He was just outside the world's top 50. He was a very good grass court player and somebody I remember from the 90s. So of course I wanted to meet him when I had the chance. And the interesting thing was that he had recently given up a very high profile and interesting job as coach of the Florida Gators university team in order to travel with his son. And that was, you know, a surprise on one level because it was such a great job, but it's his son. And so I had a chat with him, and I put to him the visual that we had of Ben in Indian Wells throwing the American football the entire length of the field and asking whether that was where the serve had come from. And he said, you know, he used to be a quarterback. You know, he wanted to be a football player for quite a long time, and he was really quite a good quarterback, and that is where the serve comes from. But he eventually concentrated on tennis, and he was talking about how from that Australian Open he then decided to just really stamp that passport and go to Europe and plod around the clay court circuit and hardly win any matches, certainly not win any back-to-back matches at all between the Australian Open and here in New York. But he said it was an education for him, and they wouldn't do it again next year. They would probably prioritize grass a little bit more. And it was just a really interesting conversation, and Brian had a real effect on me, and particularly towards the end of the interview, I've just thought about what he's had to say a lot since then, and we thought we'd just play a few minutes of it for you. Starting with me asking why, in his junior years, Ben didn't play much tennis.
Yeah, well, we wanted Ben at home with the family, and so we kind of forego playing the international events and chasing points in ITF rankings and those things to really focus in on his development. First, as a person, you know, we wanted him in regular school, which he did all the way through. Today, many of the top tennis players have gone through online schooling as kids, and we wanted him to really understand what it felt like to be part of something that's at home And my wife, Lisa, and I, we really wanted to have an impact on him every single day. And so it's hard to do that when your kid's living somewhere else or traveling around the world. And so for us, that was really important that he had just a solid foundation and base and a lot of different skills. And going to college was also something that was, you know, a reality. And we really wanted him to experience that, being part of a team and understanding that, you know, you're not the most important person all the time. And you got to learn how to share and work with others and just developing so many character traits that we think are really, really important. And I think those things will serve him well, and hopefully he'll have a long career and a fruitful one, but always be able to keep things in perspective based on the foundation that we've kind of been able to set for him.
You're able now to have an influence on him day to day on the road as well, because you're here. A dad and a son on the road all the time together, is that ever tricky?
I think it will be. I think it will be tricky at times, and I think it's really, really important that we understand, you know, how to work well together and continue to, you know, be on the same page there. You know, he needs that time where he can go have dinner with his friends and enjoy some time without mom or dad around, you know, because he's 20 years old and he's got to learn and experience things on his own. And so it's finding the time to put my coach hat on and understand that there's work to be done, and we're going to work well together on the court because we have a long history of doing that so far. But also understanding when it's time for me to kind of not talk about tennis or not be around and give him the space that he needs to be able to grow and develop and just be a normal 20-year-old, you know, and moving forward from there. So, you know, I think that we'll be able to find that balance. It's something that we have mutual respect for one another, and I think that that's something that we both value and something that I'm going to be just very aware of as we move forward.
Just as a final question, and there's only so much crystal ball gazing we can do successfully, and other things being equal, injuries come into a player's development. But if those things are equal, if he doesn't suffer bad injuries, in terms of timeline, how long do you think it will take for him to reach his physical potential, or at least to develop and to be fully ready for the rigors of the circuit in the way that maybe he one day will be? How long do you think it will take?
You know, it's hard to put a timetable on development and maturity and growth and those things. And, you know, I think if we continue to learn from each match, each day, each practice, and continue to grow in that way, then he's going to continue to move in the right direction. And one thing I know for sure is that I'll never put limitations on what he can accomplish. You know, I learned that, you know, a few years back and realized that he's just so different than I am. And the limitations that I put on myself, I certainly would not want to put on him, because he doesn't put any limitations on himself. You know, I think he sees himself as being one of the best players in the world ultimately. And so I think that that's certainly something that he can accomplish. And, you know, we're not in any rush. You know, the most important thing is that he just continues to get better each day. And as he has the right mindset, then I think he'll be consistent with the results that he has. And so it's about developing that mindset, developing his body, developing his game and his skills, and just letting it kind of just run a natural course with the work that he puts in.
Sorry, Brian, I just found that fascinating that you talk about limitations that you put on yourself, but you're keen not to put on him. That suggests that you're quite different, or that you've maybe almost learning from him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the things that I thought years ago were weaknesses, I realized were strengths. You know, Ben was one of those kids that when he went to a tournament at a young age and came home, and after losing in a quarterfinals, I'd ask him, what do you need to do to get better, Ben, to be able to win that match the next time? And he would say, Dad, I just need to grow and get stronger. Once I do that, I'll have a lot of success out there against guys like that. I'll continue to beat them. I kept thinking to myself, that's not the right attitude. But now I look back and I realize that he had an internal confidence that I didn't have at the same age or the same stage. And I really needed to continue to help him just grow that confidence in himself and build his self-esteem, which was already pretty strong, and realize that, man, this is a different guy that I'm talking to right now than myself. I wish I had that mentality or that attitude when I was coming through at his age.
What a lovely chap, and such a fascinating insight, and gives you faith that it might be possible to be a top tennis player and a well-adjusted human being.
Yes.
At the same time.
Yeah, I think, as a father myself, I can really relate to what he's saying. I'm trying to wrestle with not imposing my experiences exclusively on my young son, because he's very different to me. And I found it fascinating, and seeing their interaction together with Brian and the coaching box, and the freedom that Ben Shelton plays with, and the charisma he has. He just loves it, and he loves performing and showing you how incredible he is athletically, and not holding that back. And watching what he does tomorrow will be so fascinating, because he's playing the ultimate. He's playing in words of Simon Briggs today, he's playing the ultimate winning machine in Novak Djokovic. And is there a way to disrupt that with that kind of chutzpah and power, raw power? It's going to be fascinating.
Matt Roberts thinks no.
I do love it when David says chutzpah, though.
It's good. Right, let's get to bed, folks. It's 3:08. We have some very important stuff to say first, though. We have to say hello to Willow, our lovely, lovely mascot. Hello, Willow. We have to say hello to Xenia. Hello, Xenia. We were a 6-love set away from getting some points today. No biggie. David has to say hello to Maisie.
All right, Maisie. I turned 50 today, and your little face was there on my phone. Oh, so nice.
And Matt and Darwin.
Yep, no points.
None of us got any points.
Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers. You know them well. They're Jamie, Hannah, and Drew. And we have late night shout outs, Matt.
For Aaron Farkas in Los Angeles.
Oh, hello, Aaron.
Aaron Crickstein.
Yeah.
From 1991, Jimmy Connors
fame. And other years.
Yes, but that's the one we all remember from when it used to rain and there wasn't a roof. And so they'd play that match all the time.
There must be other tennis Aarons. I think of Aaron as quite an athletic name.
It is a good athletic name, yes, and I can't think of any.
What's an unathletic name?
Clive.
Well played.
Thank you, Aaron.
There's no arguing with that, is there?
Clive.
Owen?
Owen.
Clive.
Not an athlete.
No. Clive the Glide Drexler. Clive. Basketball player from 1992.
Clive Woodward? Did he play rugby?
Michael Jordan.
As well as coaching?
No, there's exceptions to every rule. All right, Derek.
I think you're definitely on something.
Thank you, Aaron.
We have Debbie Thorpe.
I thought we were saying Derek.
I've just realised it wasn't Clive, actually. Clive the Glide Drexler. It was Clyde. Is that an athletic name?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're right, I'm wrong. I've had a whiskey.
Debbie
Thorpe.
All right, Derek.
We know Debbie Thorpe.
That's an athletic surname.
Yes. Yep. Ian Thorpe, the torpedo.
Yeah. The one with the big feet who used to be really good at swimming.
Yep.
He had 16
They've
feet.
They've always got big feet, haven't they?
I mean, obviously I noticed that because I've got the same size feet, which was really cool.
Yeah.
For me.
I think swimmers do have big hands. Yeah. I mean, Michael Phelps has got big hands and feet, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, Debbie.
Right, Debbie.
Like Debbie McGee.
Have we not got a tennis player, Debbie?
Deborah Jevons. Debbie Jevons.
The new Wimbledon chairman.
Yep. There so we go. There we Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks, Debbie.
Speaking of Michael Phelps, there's an M. Phelps in the junior tournament here. I was very confused because Michael Phelps was here
There's an L Samsonova.
Yeah. I noticed that.
And an M,
And there's an M Phelps.
It's a fake Samsonova. And she's doing really well, so she might be a problem. Thank you, Debbie.
And finally, we have Sam Wood.
All right, Sam.
And hello, Sam.
Sam says that the highlight of her tennis year so far was chatting with Catherine and David on Centre Court.
I remember it well.
During Świątek Bencic.
Yes.
Oh, yes, oh, I do too.
It was so nice to meet you, Sam.
Lovely and to meet
you. Sam was wearing a Tennis Podcast T-shirt.
Yes.
That was lovely.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, like Claire Sam. Wood.
Yeah.
And like Sam...
Stosa.
She's here, isn't she, doing commentary? Well, yeah. Oh, that's a lovely one to end on. Thank you, Sam. Thank you to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast. If you'd like to become a friend, if you're worried about post-US Open withdrawal symptoms, Friends of the Tennis Podcast has got you covered with all of our boco. We'll be doing a review show and a Q&A show next week. We've got all sorts of other stuff planned. We still have Tennis Relived shows to bring you for 2023. There's all sorts coming your way. And the way to get access to it is by becoming a friend and supporting us year round in what we do. The link to do that is in our show notes, as is the link to subscribe to the newsletter, the link to enter the competition. All the good stuff is in the show notes, folks. Thanks for listening.
Can I just say a quick thank you as well, please?
You just did.
To you and to Matt. For giving me my best ever US Open birthday in 20 years. They took me out to lunch. They spoiled me rotten. They brought all my favourite colleagues together, apart from Pam, because she couldn't make it. But she bought me a lovely bottle of whiskey. She was on air. She could make it. And they're taking me to an NFL game on Monday. And I cannot wait. It's the coolest present imaginable. And I just wanted to say a huge thank you to you both.
You're very welcome, David.
Very welcome.
You're worth it. I'm going to an NFL game on Monday.
Men
go Bills. That's the headline there.
Men bending over. Can't wait.
There'll be content.
Yes.
Yeah. Boko.
I'll be excited.
Speak to you tomorrow.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.